Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. Before it became so easy for us to stay up at night, cross time zones in a single afternoon, and eat at any time of the day, humans were inclined to live in accordance with natural light-dark cycles. It's probably no accident that along with these lifestyle changes, we've entered an era marked by chronic illness, the so-called mismatched diseases. Metabolic disorders are often attributed to eating too much or consuming the wrong kinds of food, but fascinating research from just the last several years suggests we're also eating at the wrong time of day. With me today on the podcast is writer, speaker, and researcher Greg Potter, PhD, to talk about chrononutrition, how the foods we eat and the times we eat them impact our inner clocks and metabolic health. Greg discusses how changing when you eat can have profound effects, including reducing blood glucose, insulin and appetite, and even better outcomes with COVID-19. He breaks down specific macronutrients to eat, when to eat them, and in what order to optimize the body's inner timekeeper. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to office hours, where my scientific director, Megan Hall, answers questions twice a week. You can submit all your own questions, as well as listen to the replays, covering everything from birth control to bicarbonate for muscle soreness. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and you can sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's interview with Greg Potter. Well, Greg, thank you for joining me this morning. Well, actually the evening for you, isn't it? How's your day been going?
It's been going well. I had another podcast this morning with Nathan Rose from Metagenics, which was great. I always really enjoy speaking with him. And then I had a business call this afternoon and have spent the last couple of hours preparing to speak with you, Chris.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think I might be suffering from a little bit of social jet lag this morning. Are you familiar with social jet lag, Greg?
Never heard of it.
So, yeah, I don't know how we got into this routine, but the last couple of Saturday nights, we've ended up spending most of the evening talking and maybe a little bit of wine and perhaps some hot tubbing. And the evening ends about 2 a.m. and then I wake up feeling like I've been hit by a train. Are you familiar with this feeling?
I am. What's so strange is that I spoke with Nathan this morning and he began by asking me whether I was experiencing any social jet lag today. So, bizarre coincidence.
I just always think of you when I think of social jet lag. I try not to do that. I think I'm got to get out of the habit of that. It's like not a good thing. And then I can feel it even this morning. Last night, we all slept like dead people. I think we all woke up in the same position that we went to sleep in, and we went to sleep before it got dark. There's definitely a flip side to the social jet lag. I think the sleep pressure is like, it's pretty amazing, isn't it, when you have an incredible night of sleep like that, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, our bodies are good at defending the sleep that they need. So the occasional bad night of sleep is normally compensated for in short measure.
Right. Well, I wanted to talk to you today about chrononutrition, which I think is a fascinating topic. And I think I first learned about this topic from a client. Can you believe that? The empirical route. And this client, it was a 50-something-year-old woman, and she'd come to us because her fasting blood glucose was impaired, right? She was in the diabetic range, even though there was no sign of excess energy, right? She was thin. She was otherwise healthy. She had some few minor complaints, but nothing serious. And, you know, we did the usual things. We went through what we now call Josh's 4-quadrant model, right? Where we try to minimize mismatch. And then we think about some quadrant 2 disruptive stuff. And we also did some lab testing and we definitely found some problems. If you do some lab testing, you're definitely going to find some issues that are fixable. And so we fixed those. I think there was a yeast overgrowth, if I remember correctly. And of course, this is almost true when we sign a client up. We never really know whether we're going to fix your problem. You know, we're just going to go through the same routine. And sure, everything is personalized, but we don't know with certainty whether we can fix the exact thing that you came to us complaining about. And anyway, so she felt better. She was very happy overall, but still the impaired fasting glucose. And then I remember maybe 6 months, maybe probably more actually, after working with this client, she came back to me and she said, you know what, I fixed that thing. You're not going to believe this. And I'm like, well, go on, tell me, spill the beans. And it was like, I just needed to eat dinner earlier. I just had started eating dinner at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I started waking up with fasting glucose in the 80 something milligrams per deciliter. And so I thought, no, that can't be it. And so I went back and I had dinner late again one night. And sure enough, it was in the diabetic range the next morning. It's like, it was a very repeatable thing. And that was really all she needed to do to fix her fasting blood glucose. I was like, what the heck? Like, what's going on here? Like, and so that was what spawned my interest in chrononutrition. But maybe there's a better definition that we can start with. Can you talk about what the word means?
Yeah, and just to touch on fasting glucose, that's interesting because it has been shown that early time restricted eating may help reduce fasting glucose, and you're more likely to see that effect in people who have impaired fasting glucose. But when we speak about chrononutrition, what we're talking about is the reciprocal relationship that exists between our body's clocks, our circadian systems, and our nutrition. And what I mean by that is that what and when we eat will influence the function of our body's clocks. But also, it's possible to use an understanding of the circadian regulation of our cardiometabolic health to help optimize our diet timing to align what we eat with when our bodies are best prepared for food.
Okay. And can you give us a brief overview of the circadian system? It's quite complicated, but I think you can summarize it really well. And I think that might be some important background here.
Sure. There's a master clock in the circadian system. And this is largely set by our patterns of exposure to light. Specifically, we have specialized cells in our eyes that detect information about our light environments and then relay this information back to the master clock, which then signals a running record of our light exposure back to the pineal gland. The pineal gland in turn synthesizes melatonin during the dark period, and melatonin then circulates throughout our bodies, acting on receptors in various tissues to tell them that it's the nighttime and thus to engage in nighttime activities. But that's not the only mechanism by which the master clock relays information with tissues elsewhere in the body. It also uses mechanisms such as body temperature regulation. It produces some paracrine secretions too, and it sends signals via the nervous system. But interestingly, the molecular clocks that keep the cells in our master clock ticking are also present in cells elsewhere in our bodies, and we refer to these as peripheral clocks. And these peripheral clocks seem to be relatively responsive to our patterns of eating and fasting. And we can't really say that in humans right now, but there's tentative evidence that that's the case. And the purpose of these peripheral clocks is, as I mentioned earlier, to optimize our bodies for physical activity and for nutrition during the daytime, and then for sleeping and resting and fasting during the nighttime. So just to some examples of these, we find that the clocks in our digestive system will produce rhythmic changes in our gastrointestinal tracts, things like motility, how well we digest food, how well we absorb it, electrolyte balance. Then there are time of day changes in diet-induced thermogenesis, which is the increase in metabolic rate that's present for several hours after eating. There are time of day changes in insulin sensitivity. And there was a meta-analysis published by some Australian scientists last year showing that research has quite consistently shown that when people consume a given meal early in the day, they have lower postprandial glucose and insulin responses than when they consume it later in the day. And then there are, of course, time of day changes in immune function. This has been best studied in rodents. And if you expose mice, for example, to pathogens by way of food or the air at the start of when they were naturally asleep, then they're less likely to survive than when they're exposed to them when they'd normally be awake. And then there are various other changes too. So, for example, there are changes in multiple aspects of cardiovascular function. And the sum of those changes basically means that our bodies are better prepared for stresses and less reactive to stresses around the middle of our biological days, as opposed to, for example, very early in the waking day. And that might help explain why cardiovascular events such as heart attacks tend to cluster very early in the day. And then one more of these is that our peripheral clocks may affect our musculoskeletal systems, such that our bodies are better set for physical activity in the afternoon. And I think I've probably discussed this in previous podcasts, but there is a clear circadian rhythm in core body temperature, such that core body temperature is highest in the late biological afternoon. And in part, as a result of that, we tend to be strongest at that time of day. So you might be better set to do strength and power exercise in the late biological afternoon than at other times of day. Whereas earlier in your waking day, when your core body temperature is a bit lower, it may be, and this is speculative, but it may be that because your core body temperature is low and because it seems that when your brain reaches a certain temperature, it effectively shuts down your ability to exercise because you have a greater range of increase in temperature that's available to you, doing endurance exercise a little bit earlier in the day may be preferable. You may be able to push your limits a little bit more. But as I said, that is speculative.
Okay, it certainly fits with the central governor model of fatigue, right? Where you put cyclists on a stationary bicycle in a hot room and they start producing less power than they would in a cooler room right from the outset, right?
Yeah, and interestingly, going back to strength and power exercise, if you look at world records in strength and power events, then they're generally set at about 8 p.m. So this really can have quite a pronounced effect on how our bodies function. And if you take untrained people and you measure, for example, maximal strength across the 24-hour cycle, then the difference between when core body temperature is at its nadir and when core body temperature is at its highest can be about 8%. That's typical.
Right.
So if you imagine doing training at the optimal biological time of day and comparing that to doing training at the least optimal time of day, then over time, that might amount to something quite substantial.
Is there a way for people to know whether the circadian rhythm is correctly aligned? I always wonder about that. Like, how do I know that it's off? Like, can you explain why it's right? But I'm guessing it'd be easier for you to explain to people how they'll feel if it's off.
A bit like when you're jet lagged.
Right, exactly how I'm feeling yesterday morning, right? Everybody knows that feeling.
Yeah, exactly. That's the most salient example of how circadian misalignment can feel, I think. And we won't go into the details of circadian misalignment because it can occur at multiple levels of the circadian system. And there are different types of misalignment, from external misalignment to internal misalignment. But if anyone's ever flown across more than three time zones and has woken up the next day feeling pretty hammered, that's what circadian misalignment can feel like.
It's a funny feeling, isn't it? It's like, it's very different from other types of fatigue that you feel. It's like a very specific feeling to me. Let's drill down and talk about some of the ways in which the timing of our food can affect our circadian rhythm. So I think previously on the podcast, you've done a really good job of explaining how light is the main driver of circadian rhythm. But there are other things that are important too, including food. So can you give us an overview of how our food timing and composition can affect our circadian rhythm?
Yeah, I can touch on that. What I would say is, I think the thing that most people are interested in is how changing food timing can affect their overall health. Because truth be told, I don't think that we fully understand how it affects our circadian system just yet.
Okay.
At a mechanistic level. And these studies have largely been preclinical, as you might imagine. And in short, it seems that various different things in food may influence the molecular clocks that tick in our cells. And people speculate as to what those different components might be. And they include things like the energy content of food to certain fatty acids, to heme, to changes in the redox state of cells in response to feeding. But going to a higher level, namely, how does the time at which we eat and drink affect other aspects of circadian function and overall health? A lot of people in recent years have become increasingly interested in this concept I briefly mentioned earlier, which is time-restricted eating. And a lot of the early work on this looked at the effects of time-restricted feeding in non-human animals. And typically this entails restricting access to food for a period of 12 hours or less each day. And the preclinical research that's been done is very compelling. There have been several experiments in fruit flies showing that when you give fruit flies access to food round the clock, and then you give another group of fruit flies access to food in, for example, a 12-hour period each day, then over time, even though they consume an equivalent number of calories, the fruit flies will gain less weight, they'll have better cardiac function, they'll have better muscle function, they'll sleep better as they age, and they'll effectively age more slowly. And there have also been many experiments done in mice, and much of this work has been done by Sachin Panda's group. And I know that you've had Sachin on the podcast previously. And to briefly summarize this, this work has shown that when you give mice access to so-called high-fat diets, which really are high-sugar diets too,
right, they're a their circadian diet. System,
yeah, their circadian systems function worse, and they end up eating round the clock. So their patterns of activity and sleep become disrupted. And if you then restrict their access to high-fat chow, again, they consume an equivalent number of calories, but their gut microbiota better mimics that of healthy mice. Again, they gain less weight over time. They're less likely to develop fatty liver disease. They have lower inflammation, better insulin sensitivity. They even have improved physical function. So they'll tend to run longer, and they may have better coordination too. So all of this preclinical research is very interesting, but of course, humans aren't fruit flies or mice. And so off the back of this research, there's been a surge in the number of publications on time-restricted eating that's come out in recent years. And we can start to unpack some of those if you like.
Sure. But just before we do, why don't they start in humans with something like this? It's not like we're talking about some novel molecule that may be toxic or ineffective. Like, why not just start in humans for like for someone like Sachin Panda?
You'd have to ask Sachin that. But I think...
sorry, I apologize. No, it's just, I just had you on the phone, you know.
Yeah, sorry. I think it probably reflects control and also the fact that 12 weeks in a mouse's life is a relatively long period of time, whereas 12 weeks in a human's life is not so long. So if you can more tightly control the experimental conditions, humans aren't very good at doing what you tell them to do. And if you can assess the effect of an intervention over a longer proportion of an animal's lifespan, then you're more likely to identify some sort of signal among the noise.
Right. Okay. All right. So let's talk about some of the different options here. You know, I hear all these terms battered around and sometimes I get confused and I'm not sure what each of them means. You know, sometimes you hear people talking about time-restricted feeding and sometimes intermittent fasting. And then we talk a lot about early time-restricted feeding. You know, maybe it's just breakfast skipping. I don't know. Like, so can you define some of these terms and explain what each of them might offer us?
Sure. And I think your confusion is understandable, because I don't think there's consensus on some of the numbers that are involved in defining, for example, time-restricted eating versus intermittent fasting. The way that I define these things, and I'm not saying that this is right, this is just the heuristic that I use, but time-restricted eating, as I touched on earlier, is confining all calorie-containing items to a period of 12 hours or less each day, whereas intermittent fasting is periodic use of a longer fast, namely a fast which is 24 hours or longer. And one of the reasons that I make that distinction is that I think that time-restricted eating and intermittent fasting may at times have quite different effects on, for example, the circadian system. And Karen Small from King's College in London has found that, for example, fasting sometimes produces opposite effects on the expression of certain genes in certain cells to those of feeding, in this instance, time-restricted eating. So with that said, there are then different types of fasting. So for example, people may use alternate day fasting, which would be complete abstinence from any calorie-containing items every other day. Then there's modified alternate day fasting, and it's a bit of a misnomer, but this might entail, for example, consuming 125% of your caloric requirements on one day and then 25% on the next, such that on average, your caloric deficit is about 25%. Then there is the so-called 5-2 diet, which would be fasting on two consecutive days each week. Then there's modified 5-2, which might look like something like 25% of caloric needs on two of the days each week. And then, of course, within those non-fasting periods, there are different types of restriction too. So I spoke about time restriction earlier, but then there is nutrient restriction. Sometimes that's just a gross reduction in calories across the board. Sometimes people might restrict their carbohydrate intake, sometimes their fat intakes, and so on. So broadly speaking, I'd split it into time restricted eating versus intermittent fasting. And then within those, I would look at the effects of restricting certain nutrients, be they macronutrients or otherwise.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you. Who do you know that really does intermittent fasting on a regular basis? Certainly we have some clients that are very much better than me at doing extended water fasts, and they do those periodically, sometimes quarterly, for example. I really suck at doing it, and I've really not been that successful. I've done the fasting mimicking diet one time, and it was really pretty awful. And I think part of the reason it was awful was because I really like riding my bike, and riding your bike on 700 calories a day is really tough, or even less. Am I just like just caught in some bubble? Do you know people that are successfully doing intermittent fasting on a regular basis?
I think the research shows that people can do it successfully on a relatively regular basis. The lady who's done the bulk of this research is Krista Varady, who's at one of the US universities. In terms of people who I know personally, there aren't many of them. And they're generally so-called biohacking enthusiasts. So, for example, one of my friends is a psychiatrist, and he will periodically do extended water fasts or dry fasts, and he swears by their efficacy. He, for example, anecdotally says that the first extended fast that he did more or less cleared up his arthritis itself. And I struggle to believe that, as much as I love him. But I think it is those people who have a very strong interest in their health,
right,
and maybe more willing to adopt more extreme approaches than most people are. And I think that intermittent fasting, so this type of periodic use of a longer fast, is something that I would typically recommend for people just after they've overindulged, or if they want to reconsider their relationship to food. So for example, if you have a client who's very obese, and they're used to eating around the clock, as we might get to later. People in many Western countries will, on average, consume calories over maybe 15 hours or so each day, which is quite an extended period over which to eat and drink things. If you take those people and then you have them do a 24-hour fast at the start of your relationship with them, then they'll start to remember what hunger actually feels like. And I think it can reset both their relationship to food, but also make them better aware of what hunger actually feels like, and then help them later on when they're using a more regular form of less severe restriction.
Yeah, that certainly resonates with me. You know, back in, I don't know, 2010 or something, before I started any of this, I was just hungry all the time. Like I don't remember a time when I wasn't hungry. I literally could have eaten at any time of the day or night. We've had a client actually that's been tracking blood chemistry before and after. Like, it sounded like you were suspicious of your psychiatrist friend's subjective life experience, but we have a client that's been tracking blood chemistry before and after each of these water fasts. And it's nothing fancy. It's just a basic blood chemistry we run on all of our athletes. And then we compute this 5-year wellness score that comes from the Horn paper. Sometimes it's referred to as the Intermountain Risk Score. And the results are very consistent, that he sees a change in that score before and after the fast that's very, very repeatable, and it is a big delta. And so now he has this dashboard with a sine wave on it that, like, I'm not sure whether there's a pattern, you know, whether the score is gradually getting better over time, but it's definitely doing something. I just don't fully understand what it is that it's doing.
And what are some of those changes that he sees?
So there's a, I believe, and like, maybe I'll check this and follow up for the show notes, but I think initially the score gets much better, but then it gradually declines over time in the period between the fast, and then he bumps it back up again, and then it gradually goes down. And I can't explain any more than that. I have no idea what's going on under the hood.
Interesting.
So tell us about the macros there. You touched earlier on the idea that it may make a difference what time of day we eat the various macronutrients, perhaps carbohydrate, fat, and protein.
Sure. This is very interesting, in my biased opinion. But I first became interested in this when I was looking at research done by a lady named Danielle Yakubovic. And I haven't met Danielle, but I feel like I should apologize to her because I always butcher her surname, I'm sure. But she did a study in 2013 in which she took overweight and obese women and she randomized them into two groups. And in one group, they consumed half of their daily caloric intake at breakfast. And then in the other group, they consumed half at dinner. And the diets were otherwise basically equivalent. Same number of calories, same macronutrient composition. And after 12 weeks, the people who consumed half of their calories at breakfast lost 11% of their body weight, whereas those who consumed half their calories at dinner lost only 4%. The breakfast eaters lost 8% off their waistlines, whereas the dinner eaters lost 3%. And the breakfast eaters also had greater improvements in their blood sugar regulation and their blood lipids. And she's since done some additional work looking at similar populations. And my favorite of these papers was published last year. And in this study, they took lots of individuals with type 2 diabetes and they used a similar intervention. So in this instance, one group consumed 3 meals a day with about half their calories and half their carbohydrate intake at breakfast, with only a small dinner, maybe a quarter of each. And then the other group consumed the same amount of energy and the same macronutrient composition each day, but they split it into 6 meals each day. So they had a slightly longer caloric period. And when I say caloric period, what I mean is the time elapsed between the first calories of the day and the last calories of the day. But they had a substantially smaller breakfast, so only about a fifth of calories at breakfast. And they also had a post-dinner snack. And again, the intervention was 12 weeks long, and they took lots of measures along the way. And what they found was that only the three-meal condition, in which they consumed lots of calories and carbs early in the day, led to weight loss. And they lost more than 5 kilos of weight over 12 weeks.
Wow.
Not only that, but they had substantially lower fasting, average daily and nocturnal glucose. They spent less time in hypoglycemia. And the time spent in normoglycemia for these people increased by over 80% after 12 weeks. And interestingly, they also required less insulin at the end of the intervention in the group that consumed more calories and carbohydrate at breakfast. And these effects are really quite potent. They're comparable to hypoglycemic drugs like GLP-1 receptor agonists. So I think that in these types of clinical populations, some of these changes to diet time can be really quite potent. And we're focusing at the moment on the distribution of calories across the day. But interestingly, the distribution of calories within a given dietary event may also be important. And there's a lady in New York who's done several studies on this. And to summarize these studies, what she generally has people do, and she typically looks at people with type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes, what she generally has people do is either consume the carbohydrates in a meal first, and then the protein and the fat and the vegetables about 10 or 15 minutes later, or the protein, the fat and the vegetables at the start of the meal, and then the carbohydrates about 15 minutes later. Everyone has to consume every speck of food on the plate. And what she's shown in these studies is that if you then assess people's blood sugar and insulin levels over the course of the next 3 hours or so, then on average, they're probably 40 to 70% lower when they consume carbohydrates last at meals, which probably reflects a bunch of different things, including things like gastric emptying and also maybe some effects on certain hormones like incretins. And interestingly, if you look at those hormonal responses, then one of the things that they've shown is that GLP-1 responses will tend to be more pronounced when people consume protein and vegetables and fat first. And because it's involved in satiety regulation, you might expect those higher GLP-1 responses to actually lead people to eat less in the real world too. So you're not only going to reduce people's blood sugar excursions to meals, but they might also eat less, which you'd expect to have an additive effect on benefiting their cardiometabolic responses. So when it's applicable, because I recognize that many meals that we eat are just mushed together and it's not possible to separate the protein from the carbohydrate. But when it's possible, I think especially people with poor cardiometabolic health may benefit from saving their carbohydrate-rich items for the end of events. Or if, for example, they're going to buffets, maybe they're around at a barbecue, then having some sort of protein-rich item first, or maybe, for example, beginning with a salad with some fish or some meat or some cheese or some egg may really help them in terms of their metabolic health over time.
Wow, you're blowing my mind here. So first we're saying that, well, you're saying that it makes a difference, like how many hours a day you spend putting things in your mouth. And then you're saying like the timing, where the distribution of the calories also matters. Now you're saying like even within the order in which you eat your foods might make a difference. And you just made me realize that maybe there's an important signal there. If it's not possible for you to eat the protein first because the meal is all mixed up, should you be eating that meal, right? Like that's a sign of food processing, surely.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. I think it's fair to say that I also know that people listening to this live in the real world. So for most people, most of the time, it's it's probably not possible to separate things out that much. But if, like you and I, Chris, your diet is somewhat reminiscent of a paleo diet, then it's probably more easy to do that than if you're consuming a more processed diet.
Yeah, look, maybe it should be helpful for me to tell you what I really do. Yeah, absolutely. It's always possible to separate out protein in everything I eat. And I've been doing that for a while now, actually, the protein first. And that was based on some of those studies that I saw a couple of years ago. I mean, empirically, people should be able to confirm that this is true. Start by eating the carbohydrates first and feel how hungry you are versus if you start with the protein first. Quite often I find I have to sort of choke the sweet potato down at the end, whereas before I would eat all of the sweet potatoes, you know, like Julie would batch cook them and I would eat all of them, you know, like of course it makes a difference even within the processing of the carbohydrates. So I don't binge on just plain baked sweet potatoes, but if you turn them, if you cut them into medallions and then fry them in coconut oil, then that's a different proposition, right?
Yeah, nothing like a bit of caramelization.
Exactly. So talk about the breakfast versus dinner distinction there. It's difficult, isn't it? Because when you say breakfast, what exactly is it that you mean? It sounds like a simple word, but it does deserve a definition.
Yeah. And it's another of these instances where there's not necessarily a very good definition for what breakfast is. But with that said, scientists often will use some sort of arbitrary caloric threshold to define the first meal of the day. So if you think, for example, of somebody who wakes up and has a coffee with milk in it at 8 a.m. and then eats nothing until 1 p.m., then if you were defining anything containing calories as being breakfast because you're breaking the fast, then that coffee would be breakfast. But how much is that coffee going to shift somebody's physiology towards the fed state? So some sort of detectable change in substrate utilization, for example, it's probably going to have a meaningless effect. Right. So for that reason, some people will use a threshold like 50 calories or so, but I recognize that even that's not perfect. So don't have a very good answer to that, but I'd say it's the first caloric event of the day that passes a given threshold, which might be person specific. If we're speaking about someone who's 110 kilos, comparing that person to somebody who's 55 kilos, then for the 110 kilo person, maybe it's an event that contains 100 calories, whereas for the 55 kilo person, maybe it's an event that contains 50 calories, for example.
Right. And then so what do you do about, I mean, what do they do in this study? Do they get people that come in and they're just really not hungry for breakfast? Because we see that with clients all the time.
Yeah, this is interesting. And I think one of the reasons that's interesting is that if you look at people's propensity to consume certain meals each day, then it seems like genetics contribute most to whether somebody consumes breakfast. Just let me unpack that quickly. But there's a researcher out in Spain named Marta Garrelli, and she published some work a couple of years ago in which she looked at female twins, and both monozygotic and dizygotic twins. So monozygotic twins are identical, and assessed the time of three main meals over 7 days and also looked at the midpoint between breakfast and dinner times as some sort of caloric midpoint. And what she found by comparing these different types of twins is that the heritability of the midpoint was the highest. And then after that, it was breakfast. Then it was lunch. And the heritability of dinner timing wasn't significant. So based on that, you might assume that it's easiest for people to shift around their dinner timing. And some people, regardless of how beneficial they may feel breakfast may be for them, won't ever be able to make that into a habit. This is a small study, but those data do suggest that. However, with that said, our bodies will, of course, adapt to changes in our meal patterns. And one of the reasons for these adaptations is the circadian system and changes in these molecular clocks that influence various processes in our biology. And so what you might find is that if you're not used to eating breakfast, then after 2 or 3 days of consuming it, all of a sudden at that time of day, you'll see some changes in certain hunger hormones that will lead you to expect food at that time. And you may entrain your hunger patterns to follow those patterns of food intake that you're starting to ingrain.
Well, I'm glad you addressed my objection before I even continued. Yeah, whenever anyone says heritability and twin studies, I roll my eyes. What was the size of the signal there? You know, like it sounds like, well, this seemed more important than that. But when you look at the absolute magnitude of the signal, it's like vanishingly small, like 6% of the actual behavior is explained by this signal.
Yeah. So I think in that study, the heritability for the midpoint was just over 60%.
Okay.
For breakfast, it was over 50%. For lunch, it was over 30%. And then for dinner, it wasn't significant. Okay. So make of that what you will. And yes, it is a small study. We're talking about dozens of twins as opposed to hundreds of twins.
Right. And certainly I could cite another small study that I've done with my six-year-old daughter. I'm kidding. I didn't really do a study. But yeah, I mean, you can just observe this, that when she comes into the house, we sleep outdoors in a Eurovan with a pop top, you know, and she's somehow shortchanged on sleep, that quite often happens, she's actually less vulnerable to being woken up by the activity in the house when she's outdoors in the Eurovan, which is quite nice. But if she, for any reason, she gets shortchanged on sleep, she's not hungry for breakfast, right? Whereas if she wakes up, the sun shines through the mosquito net in the pop top. And so she's like kind of gently awoken by a sunbeam on her face, which is perhaps the nicest way I can think of to wake up.
Yeah. And it may depend on the type of sleep loss that she experiences too.
Okay.
So for example, if her sleep is restricted because she goes to bed later than normal,
right,
but she wakes up at her regular time, then if anything, she might find that her appetite is higher the subsequent day, because if you look across all the different studies that have been done on different types of sleep loss, then on average, people will consume about 385 calories more after not getting enough sleep. Whereas if, for example, she wakes up early but goes to bed at her normal time, then she won't be hungry shortly after she's woken up because it's still her biological nighttime.
Right, right, right.
Maybe, for example, her pineal gland is still synthesizing lots of melatonin and she still has a fair bit of sleep inertia off the back of being woken up. And she doesn't really want much to do with the world yet.
Right.
But then later in the day, she may more than compensate for her energy requirements, again, being disposed to overeating because of that sleep loss.
Okay, that's super helpful. Thank you. And so the point you're making is that this could be trainable, you know, like if you were getting enough sleep, if you were going to bed earlier, then you may be hungrier for breakfast.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also, as people start to improve their circadian system function by enhancing their so-called Zeitgeber hygiene, so the cues that they give their body's clocks each day synchronize them with the world outside, for most people, their chronotypes will shift earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And if their chronotypes shift early, then all of a sudden breakfast becomes more palatable. So for a lot of people, especially in Western countries, as they start to get healthier and spend more time outside in daylight, their body clocks shift earlier and their meal patterns naturally start shifting earlier too. And then after a while, they may find that they not only benefit from those changes in their circadian system function, but also by being able to allocate more of their energy early in the day, they can start to reap the rewards of some of those cardiometabolic changes that I touched on earlier.
Okay. And you've raised another important point that I remember hearing you speak about a few years ago that changed my behavior. And that's the potential impact of melatonin on insulin sensitivity first thing in the morning. I've always been the type of person that goes to bed early and gets up early. And, you know, I'd heard, oh, well, early time restricted feeding for the win. I should be eating a big breakfast as soon as I get up. But if it's 5 o'clock in the morning and it's still dark outside, it might be an idea to wait. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think so. It is chronotype dependent. If you think of the extreme, you've got an elderly person who is already an early chronotype and he or she wakes up at 3 a.m. Then if it's dark outside at 5 a.m., even if it's dark outside, they've been up for 2 hours and they're wide awake. I think for that person, it's probably fine to consume breakfast at 5 a.m. Whereas in your case, if you're typically waking up around sunrise and you wake up a bit earlier than normal, I'd be inclined to wait until shortly after you naturally wake up before consuming any calories. And as a general rule of thumb, I normally suggest that people wait until at least half an hour after they naturally wake up before consuming any calorie-containing items, and then stop consuming any calorie-containing items at least 2 hours before bedtime.
Yeah, I found that it's really a good idea to wait until Julie gets up to make breakfast is like my favorite. I'm not kidding. She's so much better at cooking than me. That's a good thing for multiple reasons. What do you think about people think about the evening meal as being, you know, the family meal? And so perhaps early time restricted feeding isn't a practical concern because it means I've heard that from a number of clients, like, no, I couldn't do that. I couldn't have dinner at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon because that's the only family time I have.
Yeah. And I think for those people, it's a question of doing what they can to reduce the size of their dinner, because there have been studies done on early time restricted eating, which I haven't touched on, but one of these was by John Hawley earlier this year, and he looked at the effects of an 8-hour caloric period in people who are overweight or obese. And these people completed 2 different 5-day-long interventions, and in one condition they underwent early time restricted eating, in which they finished their final meal of the day by 5 p.m. and in the other condition they finished their final meal by 9 p.m. and that was the late eating condition. And they also assessed their attitudes to this change. And as is consistent with the other studies, they found that people's blood sugar responses were better after the early time restricted eating.
Right.
But the people said that, yes, I feel better. However, I'm not sure that I could do this given my current work schedule, my family commitments, and the presence of social events, which, to be honest, right now during the COVID-19 pandemic are out the window anyway. But with that said, I think what you have to weigh up is the pros of an early time restricted eating approach with the cons of potentially negative effects on family life. And for most people, I would say put your family first.
Right.
In which case, it all becomes about consuming a relatively smaller dinner. And that might not necessarily entail consuming a smaller volume of food at dinner. You might just consume less calorically dense items. So for example, a lean protein source with lots of fibrous vegetables and some berries, as opposed to a fattier protein source with sweet potatoes and a banana.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's going to take you a long time to chew your way through that big ass salad, right? And so, yeah, if you're sharing a meal with someone, you may still finish after them, even though you've consumed less calories.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're in a context in which you're disposed to consuming calories late at night, it just becomes a question of trying to manage your caloric intake at those times. And interestingly, there seems to be a circadian rhythm in appetite, such that appetite will tend to peak in the biological evening. And of course, that's not the optimal time at which to consume lots of calories. But when people go through this type of early time restricted eating approach, one thing that's been shown is that people's hunger tends to become more even over the course of the day. And Courtney Peterson's done some nice work showing this in recent years. And she specifically looked at a short-term intervention in which people either finished their final meal by about 3 p.m. or by about 9 p.m. And what she found was that the early time restricted eating condition again improved blood sugar responses, but also importantly made appetite more even keeled. And it also tended to reduce average ghrelin levels, which corresponds with that reduction in appetite. So we know something about the biological basis of that change in appetite too.
Why would that be? Why would the biological peak of appetite come at a time when your metabolism is not? Is that just an artifact of studying real life people?
It's fascinating, isn't it? I had a feeling that you were going to ask that, Chris, just given that you're always wearing your evolutionary biology hat.
Right.
I haven't thought about it before. However, with that said, shooting from the hip, if you think about the fact that we are daytime active and we're therefore most likely to be out hunting and foraging during the daytime, then the most likely time of day at which we're going to be consuming calories is relatively late in the day. And if you also consider that traditionally, we might have been disposed to not getting enough energy, then being more thrifty in terms of our ability to store energy might in some circumstances have been adaptive. So therefore, making people more hungry later in the day, at a time of day at which they're disposed to storing lots of that energy as opposed to burning it off, may have helped people fatten up ahead of lean times.
Yeah. That's a good
but
point.
But that's very speculative.
That. No, it does make sense though, doesn't it? The seasonal availability of foods. Yeah, sure. It has to be a thing, right?
Yeah, I suspect so. You see it in other animals.
And that's certainly been my experience as well. But I always assumed it was because, you know, I like to ride my bike in the early afternoons and then I'm hungry after that. But I would be hungry after that if I started my ride at 6 a.m., right? And the reason I wait until later to ride is because I find that the ride just takes the edge off my energy levels, you know? So I don't really want to live with a mild fatigue for the rest of the day if I'm working doing client calls and podcasting and whatnot. And so I tend to keep my ride later in the day, even though it's stinking hot here in California.
Yeah.
So it could be 90 degrees when I start my ride, but that's fine. I've kind of adapted to that.
That raises a really important point though, namely that people should consider the timing of their exercise when tuning the timing of their diet. And because most forms of exercise will lead to a substantial increase in non-insulin dependent glucose uptake in muscles and metabolic rate, it may make sense to reapportion a substantial amount of your calories around the exercise bout. And if you are an elite athlete, then you might undergo some sort of nutritional periodization in which, for example, you do some sessions with relatively low carbohydrate and energy availability, and it might make sense to do these early in the morning. And then other sessions in a fed state with full glycogen tanks. And given that body temperature is higher in the afternoon, if these are higher velocity or higher quality sessions or strength training sessions, then it makes sense to do that type of activity later in the day. So I think there's slowly some consensus emerging that that type of approach is likely a good strategy for endurance athletes. Mm-hmm. And then for the strength and power athletes who train twice a day, I think if they're training in the morning, then they might just need a slightly longer warm-up before the activity to raise their core body temperature closer to optimal levels. And then in the afternoon, if they've done heavy stuff in the morning, then they might do lighter stuff because the early session may have been somewhat depleting. Mm-hmm. Or if their morning session is very light, so if we speak about a sprinter and the morning session was just some block starts and some jumps, and then their afternoon session was a heavy strength training session with relatively high volume because it was early in the off season, then it might make sense to consume more calories later in the day after that strenuous second bout.
You know, you raised an important point earlier, and I wonder if you had any more thoughts, and that's how COVID has changed things. That, you know, I think it was Joshua Fields Milburn that said, I've been self-quarantining for years, and I kind of felt the same, you know, that maybe I started quarantining in 2014 when I quit my job at the hedge fund to start MBT, and it didn't really have that much of an impact on our daily routine because we were eating all of our meals together already, and I could already choose when to exercise and all of these things that you hear people, including you, talking about on podcasts that seem somewhat impractical. But now there's this great opportunity, isn't there? If like you're working remotely and there's no particular obligation to turn up at specific times, then could you alter your routine so that you are eating a bigger breakfast? And that, so we've been eating dinner at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for years, and that sounds terrible to most people I talk to, but it's just our routine. We've been doing it a long time and we don't really think about it anymore.
So I think that's absolutely right. And if you look at how people's sleep has changed during the pandemic, then it seems that for many people, their sleep has become more regular at this time. And while that has happened and people are spending a little bit longer in bed each day, at the same time, their sleep quality in general has deteriorated. And the studies that I'm referring to at the moment were done in relatively healthy, affluent people. So given that these people are better prepared to cope with a pandemic like this, it may be that people who are less fortunate may have experienced greater disruption to their right. sleep than these people. But as I was touching on, there is the possibility to have more control over our schedules now, to get more complete sleep than people did previously, and also to start dabbling with some of these changes in the circadian distribution of things like nutrition. And interestingly, there's a little bit of research that came out recently suggesting that diet timing may have some effect on how detrimentally people are affected by contracting COVID-19. And this, of course, is observational data, so I would certainly take it with a pinch of salt, but it is very interesting. And specifically, this work was done by a group of Spanish researchers. And what they did was they looked at the timing of diet relative to the timing of sunset. And they found that across Europe, people in countries where diet was consumed relatively later were more likely to pass away from COVID-19 than those who consumed it relatively earlier. And they speculate that this was because of the late diet timing being some proxy of circadian disruption. So if people aren't spending lots of time outside exercising during the day, their chronotypes drift later, they eat later, they're generally less healthy people, they're therefore more likely to be negatively affected by COVID-19. So I wouldn't read too much into those data. And another consideration is that in those countries where people were dying more frequently from COVID-19, those people were probably at different stage in their pandemics. So if, for example, people were confined to staying indoors, then those conditions aren't conducive to good circadian system function for lots of people. So it may be that their health was therefore worse. So of course they'd be more susceptible to the negative effects of COVID-19. But to go back to your point, I think, yes, now is a really good time for people to start to experiment with some of these things and to try and better optimize the timing of their activities according to their individual chronotypes. So you might think, for example, about when you're most productive in your working day and when the best time of day for you to exercise is, when it makes sense for you to eat. And given that lots of people don't have the types of social and family commitments that they previously would have had, why not dabble with some of these variables?
Yeah, absolutely. But you touched on something I think is really important, and it seems almost negligent not to bring this up, is that post-traumatic growth is a sign of privilege. Like, it's fine for you and me, you know, where we don't have additional exposure through our job and we do have the freedom to choose when we eat and the quality of the food and such and such. And it seems like for all those people, they get stronger, right? They get post-traumatic growth. Whereas the people who are already struggling, they go the other way, right? It's post-traumatic stress.
Yeah. And this is interesting because I hadn't considered this before, but if you have somebody who doesn't have much money and therefore feels like he or she has to subside on certain foods and drinks, then all of a sudden diet timing might become relatively more important for that person. They might not have the means to choose a higher quality diet. I know one of the things that you've asked me about previously is how important is when you eat compared to what you eat. This is probably one of those instances in which when somebody eats is relatively more important. And of course, when versus what isn't something that's been addressed directly. And it'll be a really interesting experiment to do. And I've got some thoughts as to how somebody might do that, although I haven't given it much thought at all. But I think for these people, leveraging some of this information that we're discussing today may be particularly beneficial. And this also brings up another point, which is that people sometimes speak about these things in isolation, but of course, the timing of somebody's caloric period will influence the composition of what they eat and drink to. Just think about the daily distribution of different dietary items. Most people have cereal at breakfast,
right,
and most people drink alcohol late in the day,
right,
if all of a sudden you're using some sort of earlier time-restricted eating approach, then maybe you're less likely to consume as much alcohol as you were previously. And the other thing is that if you're consuming your alcohol earlier, even if you consume the same quantity of alcohol, then that would be less likely to interfere with your sleep. And just add one more thought here. The relative importance will probably depend on other contextual factors too. So it may be, for example, that diet timing is a relatively stronger Zeitgeber or time cue in shift workers because they have weaker light-dark cycles than the rest of us do. And it may be that for somebody whose diet composition is already good, diet timing is relatively more important than somebody whose diet composition isn't so good, but the diet timing is good. And one more thought, the outcome of interest will also likely influence whether diet timing or composition is more beneficial. So it may be that diet timing is more important to circadian system function and sleep, whereas for most people, composition is more important to, for example, micronutrient status.
Okay, that's very helpful. Maybe I should just give you a quick checklist to summarize here. I'll tell you what I'm doing, right? Like, let's not tell people what to do. I'll tell you what I'm doing. And I've obviously been following your work for a long time now. So what I'm doing is, at the beginning of the day, I typically get up. At the same time, I try and be consistent. I've heard you talk about that. I think that's important. And generally, I don't wake with an alarm. And usually that happens around between 5 and 5:30 a.m. It's starting to get light here in Northern California at that time. And the house is empty, right? Like, my kids are still sleeping. Everybody's still sleeping at that time. They sleep a bit longer than me. And I find that that's perhaps my most productive time of the day work-wise, right? Like, that's a really good time to get stuff done at that time.
Yeah.
And so the only thing that I consume during that period is black coffee. So you talked about that earlier. It's arguable whether or not that breaks a fast. But then I'll wait. The rest of my family gets up and we all eat breakfast together. And I think a lot about how much I'm eating at that time. I try and eat maybe more than I really want at that time. And then the amount of food that I eat throughout the course of the day goes down gradually, right? So I eat slightly less for lunch. And then I try not to make my main meal there you go. There's my bias, like encoded in my language. I try not to make dinner the biggest meal of the day. Although that is somewhat challenging if I'm doing exercise at 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then we're usually all in bed by 9 o'clock. At the moment, it's like barely dark by the time we're in bed. And we all sleep great now. Fantastic. And that's definitely not been the case for me in the past. Oh, and of course, I did mention this earlier, the macronutrient order. So I'll definitely start with the protein first and then finish on the sweet potato. Is there anything there that you would change or raises an eyebrow?
No, not really. I think that's a good way to go in general. I wouldn't be afraid to redistribute some of your energy intake around your afternoon cycling bout if it's pretty strenuous, which I'm sure it is. And one question that arises is, how do you distribute your protein intake?
That's a good point. I've not really thought about that. I just eat what I get.
And that's a good way to go. But with that said, when I suggest that people consume relatively more of their intake earlier in the day, what I'm referring to is their carbohydrate and fat intake. Right. So if you have somebody who's on a very low carbohydrate diet, then they would consume most of their fat early in the day. If you had somebody who's on a very low fat diet, then they consume most of their carbohydrate early in the day. But I think that it makes a lot of sense to distribute protein quite evenly across dietary events. And also, I know this isn't relevant to you, but lots of people will snack and not really give their digestive systems a break at all. And I think having regular meals and doing away with snacks is very helpful for lots of people. So with that said, the question that arises is, how much protein do you want at each feeding? And obviously this is dependent on various factors, including things like your goals. So whether you're trying to maintain your body composition or gain new muscle mass, for example, or lose fat mass, your age. And in general, what the research shows is that if somebody's trying to lose fat mass, they'll benefit from a relatively higher protein intake. And if somebody is a bit older, then they'll also benefit from a relatively higher intake. They'll be a little bit more resistant to the anabolic effects of protein. But with that said, about 0.4 grams of protein per kilogram of body mass per dietary event is a good place to start for most people. Given those other factors that modify it, there's one more thing to consider, and that's the quality of the protein. And when I say protein quality, what I'm referring to is the composite of the digestibility of the protein and its amino acid profile. And there are systematic ways of scoring proteins according to their quality. And the best accepted of these at the moment is the digestible, indispensable amino acid score. It used to be the PDCAS, the protein digestibility corrected amino acid score. But in terms of protein quality, dairy proteins tend to come out on top. And in general, animal proteins are higher quality than plant proteins. So if you were a vegan, you may need a little bit more protein than if you were an omnivore. But 0.4 grams per kilogram of body mass at each of those meals, Chris, for you would probably be a good place to start.
Right.
And if anything, especially for athletes, having relatively more protein at the final meal of the day might make sense, because if you're trying to maximize your fat-free mass and minimize your fat mass, then your fat-free mass is determined by, it's determined in part by the amount of time that you spend in positive protein balance. And that is obviously affected by the rate at which you break down skeletal muscle proteins and the rate at which you synthesize new ones. It's primarily dictated by the rate at which you synthesize new ones. And if you consume more protein at your final meal of the day, then you may prolong the availability of amino acids in your bloodstream and thereby offset any protein breakdown that would occur later in the sleep period.
Oh yeah, I think I'm definitely hitting that. Megan has been very good on the podcast recently on the importance of dietary protein. And yeah, we're the sort of eggs and liverwurst for breakfast and then two cans of sardines for lunch. You know, like, in fact, it was Megan. I remember she was visiting us once. I was like, wow, you do two cans of sardines. That's bold, isn't it? And she goes, yeah, look at the can. It's only 15 grams of protein. I'm like, oh shit, yeah, you're right. And so yeah, definitely two cans of sardines for lunch and then, you know, steak for
dinner. I'm a two cans of sardines guy.
Yeah, I'm sure you're bigger than me as well. But yeah, definitely two cans of sardines. So yeah, definitely protein first. I do think about that. Well, this has been really helpful. Tell us about what you're working on now. Can you tell us about ergogenic nut butters? Are you ready to tell us about that or not quite?
Yeah, sure. So what you're referring to is this project that I've been working on this year. And the name of the company is Resilient with a T, Resilient Nutrition. And it emerged in response to some work that I did with my friend Ali, helping two guys get ready to row the Atlantic at the back end of last year.
I remember you.
We were helping them. Yeah, probably sing it from the trees. No, I'm kidding. But we were helping them with their nutrition and their sleep while they're on board. And as you can imagine, two guys who are north of 100 kilos, who are rowing around the clock, get through a lot of energy each day. And they needed products that would be stable over the course of several weeks on board and energy dense and micronutrient dense and easy to digest. And what we did was we started to develop some snacks for them. And these snacks have evolved over time as we started to use them ourselves in different contexts. And early this year, we thought to ourselves, is there a way that we can scale the production of these to help people? Because what we started to do was formulate them to enhance both physical performance and cognitive performance. And what we've ended up with is this range of nut butter based products that are better suited to different times of day, that are based on whole foods, that I hope will support performance both in the short term and the long term. We've had great feedback so far, and the rowers, through none of our work, I'm sure, ended up breaking the world record while rowing the Atlantic. So we've also had good results with them so far.
That's fantastic. And so where can people find out about that? I don't think they're ready quite yet as we're publishing this podcast, but
yeah, so it's available at resilientnutrition.com. And I think it will, so the products are called Long Range Fuel. And I think that Long Range Fuel will particularly appeal to people on relatively low carbohydrate diets, especially the ultra endurance and endurance athletes of the world, but also the knowledge workers. And I can touch on details of the ingredients and whatnot, but I think in the interest of brevity, it probably makes sense to not touch on that, but just add that we're thinking about all aspects of our company when we make these. There's no rubbish in any of them. My personal bias is very much towards a paleo type diet. So these are all whole food based products. They're delicious. And we also, of course, consider things like our own footprint on the environment. And all the products come in recyclable packaging. We give a fixed proportion of our sales to a charity named the Coalition for Rainforest Nations, so that hopefully we can help protect the rainforest biodiversity and also mitigate climate change, more than offsetting our carbon footprint. And as I said, people really like the product so far. So I really hope that people benefit from them.
Well, that's fantastic. Of course, I'll link to the website in the show notes, but will you come back on and do a whole podcast? It's surely worthy of an entire podcast. So will you agree back on and do that in the future?
Yeah, very happily. And I can certainly speak about that stuff for more than a podcast, because the stuff that we've been speaking about today, the chronic nutrition and sleep stuff, is not something I've spent nearly as much time on recently as all of the long range fuel stuff.
Excellent.
So yes, I'd be very happy to.
Excellent. And so where's the main place? I think are you posting stuff on Instagram? Is that the place for people to follow that work?
Yeah. So we're just starting to put our foot on the social media pedal, because we're hoping to launch our products around the end of July. And at this stage, we'll just be selling them in Europe. So initially, we'll be selling them at resilientnutrition.com. But then in due course, hopefully, we'll also be on Amazon, at which point we'll be able to sell throughout Europe. But yes, resilientnutrition.com is the website. And then on social media, we are at Resilient Nuts, all one word. And that's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Although I don't think we've even posted a tweet yet, but Instagram and Facebook are the places to reach out to us at.
Excellent. Well, I'll look forward to the next interview then, Greg. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you.
Pleasure. Thanks, Chris.